White Sox beat Baltimore 11-1 at the Cell. Tonight, the Brewers host the Mets up at Miller Park. Cubs are off. The White Sox take on Baltimore again. NBA playoffs, Boston beat Cleveland 96-83 to take a 3-2 series lead. Tonight, Golden State plays in Houston. That series tied 2-2. The forecast now from the National Weather Service on this Thursday, 24th of May. Sunny and warm, a high of 83 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Right now, wind is calm, the sun is shining, a lovely morning, 67 degrees, both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Build a career as a licensed professional counselor and mental health and wellness advocate with the new Master's in Mental Health and Counseling from Parkside. Visit uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. With baseball season in full swing, it's great to have the opportunity to connect with Johnny Smith, a highly regarded sports writer and actually the Julius C. Budd Shaw Professor in Sports, Society, and Technology and Assistant Professor of History at Georgia Tech and co-author of a wonderful new book called A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. Mickey Mantle, of course, looms as one of the great giants of Major League Baseball and also someone who ultimately was something of a tragic figure. His career did not last quite as long as it should have, and his sad decline as a baseball player through the 1960s was due in large part to some of the excesses of his personal life. But that should not for a moment obscure the stunning greatness of Mickey Mantle at his peak, and in particular in the season of 1956 when Mickey Mantle emerged in splendid form to be the biggest name in all of Major League Baseball. And that wonderful moment in his career is not only examined in careful detail but also set in historical context in this new book called A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. Johnny Smith, with whom I'm about to speak, has also co-written with Randy Roberts Blood Brothers, The Fatal Friendship Between Muhammad Ali and Malcolm X. Johnny Smith himself is also author of The Sons of Westwood, John Wooden, UCLA, and the Dynasty That Changed College Basketball. Again, this book, published by Basic Books, is called A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle. Johnny Smith, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really glad to be talking with you. Just ahead of us talking specifically about the book, I would love to know what it means to be the Julius C. Budd Shaw Professor in Sports, Society, and Technology. what does that mean?
Yes, well, that's a great question. Well, I'm a historian by training, and I'm a professor, a history professor at Georgia Tech. But the Julius C. Budd Shaw Professor of Sports, Society, and Technology, it's a long title, is basically an appointment that I received from Georgia Tech because we have a program in sports, society, and technology. And what that means is that we have courses for our students where they examine the relationship between sports, society, and technology. And so one of the courses that I teach is the history of American sports. And what I try to do in that class is to show students, to teach students, the important role that sports has played in the history of America, in American culture, whether we're talking about Muhammad Ali and race relations, whether we're talking about Billie Jean King and feminism in the 1970s. So what I try to do in that class is show students the intersections between sports, society, and technology. And so I happen to hold this title that supports my research and student programming, and I'm sort of one of the lead faculty members in that program.
Excellent. I'm guessing that you come to this with some kind of athletic background of your own. Can you just say a word about that, about the role that sports has played in your own life and how that has fed into the work that you do now professionally?
That's a great question. Certainly, I played sports when I was a kid. I played baseball. I played basketball. I played football. And I grew up in a suburb of Chicago. And so if you grow up in Chicago, of course, sports is so important to the people there. And I grew up in the age of Michael Jordan. And so, you know, I read the Chicago Tribune sports section every day as a kid. I loved to read box scores. I collected baseball cards. You know, I'd play catch with my brother and the kids down the street. And so this is really part of my world. But, you know, when I look back on sort of how my youth shaped my professional career, I think about how when I was a young boy, I would go to the library and I would go and I would get the books and read about the old sports stars. I loved to read about baseball stars like Jackie Robinson and Hank Aaron. And I remember, too, though, when I was a teenager that Mickey Mantle died. And when Mickey Mantle died, of course, you know, I never saw him play. I was born long after he retired. But I heard Bob Costas' eulogy, and it really helped me understand, even as a teenager, what he meant to a generation. And that's something that stuck with me. And so when Randy and I later talked about writing another book about an icon after we finished our book on Muhammad Ali, we talked about how, you know, the biographies of Mickey Mantle really don't explore what he meant in the 1950s. Because to understand Mantle is to understand the 1950s and American culture and baseball's place in it.
And so that's what you have set about doing, and I think you've done it really, really well. Ahead of us talking about his place in baseball and this portion of his career, I wonder if we could just touch for a moment on his background, his childhood spent in the little town of Commerce, Oklahoma. And what indications were there even as a youngster, that Mickey Mantle had the potential for tremendous greatness?
You know, it was his father's vision. You know, when he was born, Mutt Mantle said, I'm going to name my boy after my favorite baseball player, Mickey Cochrane. And so from the very moment that Mickey Mantle arrived in the Mantle home, you know, he was being viewed as a baseball player. And so when he was old enough to play catch and to swing a bat, his father would practice with him between their home and the shed that separated their yard. And so Mutt Mantle imagined that his son would have an advantage as a switch hitter if he could hit from the right side of the plate and the left side of the plate. Now, what we should keep in mind is that Mickey Mantle is really a product of his father's vision. There had never been a switch-hitting slugger. That is a creation of Mutt Mantle. Mickey wasn't really interested in hitting from the left side initially, but, you know, with his father's prodding, he you know, listened. But we should keep this in mind about Commerce, Oklahoma, where Mantle learned to play baseball. It's a town of poor miners, working-class men. And Mutt Mantle would finish his workday covered in dirt and soot and his overalls, and he would walk home. And he would tell Mickey, grab your bat, let's practice. I mean, Mutt Mantle will tell his son that he wanted a better life for him. You know, we have to keep in mind that Mutt Mantle spent most of his adult life working beneath the ground. Being a miner was incredibly dangerous. You know, there were all sorts of mining accidents where the rocks would cave in on men and men would get hurt or they would die. And so Mutt Mantle knew what it was like to take great risks day after day after day. And it was frightening work. It was backbreaking work. Mickey saw this. But what Mutt Mantle wanted for his boy was a life above the ground. He wanted his son to have a life playing outside in the fresh air and the sunshine, to be a baseball player. That was Mutt Mantle's dream, and ultimately Mickey Mantle fulfilled it.
We shouldn't talk about Mickey Mantle's early years without talking about a really close brush with, well, if not death, certainly amputation, when he developed something called osteomyelitis. I think this was because of a football injury that he suffered. Just explain to our listeners what a serious situation this was for young Mickey Mantle and how fortunately he was to escape physically intact.
Yeah, you know, at that time when Mickey, you're right, he got hurt during a football play, goes to the hospital, he's in severe pain, and osteomyelitis is a bone disease. And at that time, the doctors thought they might have to cut off his part of his leg. I mean, this would have ended the dream. Certainly it would have really changed the course of Mantle's life. It would have made it very difficult for him to really do much of anything. But ultimately, the doctors were able to save the leg. They were able to use medications. And so he turns out okay. But it was a scary time for a teenage boy. You know, his parents were worried about him. And, you know, he would recover. His father, you know, didn't really want him playing football to begin with. He thought it was too dangerous. He wanted Mickey playing baseball. But the other thing we should think about, too, is that Mickey Mantle was an incredible athlete. He was a great football player at a young age. He showed talent in just about everything he competed in. And so, you know, by the time he's a teenager, he's someone that scouts are looking at, and they're closely studying him. And ultimately, you know, he's going to end up with the Yankees after Tom Greenwade signs him. But you're right. That was a moment when his future was in doubt. And later in life, you know, that ankle would never be the same. He would suffer a number of injuries, and we can talk about that. But Mickey was always dealing with these doubts about whether or not his body would betray him. And that would follow him through the course of his baseball career.
We're speaking with Johnny Smith, co-author of a book called A Season in the Sun, which explores most specifically the season of 1956 when Mickey Mantle becomes a baseball superstar. The years leading up to that are turbulent, bumpy, up and down. There are certainly flashes of brilliance in his couple of years in the minor leagues, and flashes of brilliance when he finally signs on with the Yankees in 1951. But mostly, those first few seasons are seasons filled with frustration and a sense that Mickey Mantle was struggling to fulfill his immense promise and potential. Try to put that in context for us. I mean, what kind of a ball player was Mickey Mantle in his first seasons with the New York Yankees? And to whatever extent he was not playing up to his full potential, why was that so?
That's a great question. I think we forget the frustration that Mickey felt between 1951 and 1955. So let's remember this. In 1951, he comes to the Yankees as a rookie from Oklahoma, the heartland, and he's supposed to be the replacement for Joe DiMaggio. DiMaggio, of course, is playing his final season, but Casey Stengel imagines the future, his future tethered to this Superman in pinstripes, this 19-year-old kid who's been playing Class C ball, who's got the ability to do everything, it seems, to slug the ball, to run around the bases like Ty Cobb. I mean, they thought that this five-tool kid from Oklahoma was the future of the Yankees. But that season, with all those expectations, coming to the big city from a small town, playing in the shadow of Joe DiMaggio, Mantle struggles at the plate. He has a difficulty handling fastballs at the chest, who wouldn't, breaking balls. He gets sent down to the minors. And he's frustrated. He's afraid of failure. He's afraid of letting down his father. This was his father's dream. You know, he's not sure he can play at the big league level. He'll recover. He'll hit well in the minors, playing for the Kansas City club. Comes back, and he plays in the World Series in 51. But as many Mantle fans know, he shatters his knee in the World Series. And again, here he is. His future is in doubt. His body may not recover. He does manage to come back 52, 53, 54, 55. Over the course of that time, he'll play in four All-Star games. He wins three World Series. But here's the problem for Mickey Mantle. He's playing in New York City, where the expectations are enormous. The expectation that he would fulfill DiMaggio's place, that he would be the next Babe Ruth. None of that seems to have happened. And so reporters are saying he's the third best center fielder in New York. He's not as good as Duke Snyder. He's not as good as Willie Mays. The fact that he continues to suffer these serious injuries that place him on the bench for extended periods of time, reporters and fans complain that you can't count on Mickey Mantle. In the 55 World Series, when they played the Brooklyn Dodgers, Mickey was only able to start two games. The Yankees lost. He was only able to pinch hit in Game 7. It was a limp pop-up. And again, the reporters say Mantle was useless. He's unreliable. So he's carrying all of that and the frustrations. But in 55, he was the best hitter in the American League. You know, before he hurt his hamstring, you know, he had a great season. But it ended poorly, and it was another offseason of criticism and questions. So going into the 56 season, Mantle is determined. He's going to try his best, of course, to play as many games as possible. But he also realizes that he needs to endear himself to the press more. In the past, he had this contentious relationship with the sports writers. You know, on the one hand, they had built him up into this hero. But then they tore him down when he didn't fulfill their expectations. And so he didn't care for the press. And sometimes when they asked him questions and Mickey wasn't in the right mood, he'd just give them a cold glare and he wouldn't answer them, or he would curse at them and tell them to scram. But in 1956, he's determined that if he's ever going to get recognition, if he's ever going to be seen as the MVP, he's going to have to answer their questions and go out of his way to be more friendly with them.
Of course, he does more than that in that 1956 season. He, in a sense, begins to be the ball player that he had the talent to be, but had not quite managed to be in those previous seasons. In particular, of course, he ends up hitting booming home runs one after another at a pace that, at least for a time, was a quicker pace than the record-breaking season of Babe Ruth. I mean, there is every indication that he might hit more than 60 home runs in this amazing season. What can you tell us about what was different in 1956 that made Mickey Mantle the amazing hitter that he was? Was he hitting the ball differently? Was he looking at the ball differently? Was he just approaching the batter's box with greater confidence? What can you tell us about why Mickey Mantle was such a different hitter in this 1956 season?
I think it's a great question. Let's keep this in mind, too. In 1956, he's 24. You know, he had been so young in those preceding seasons. He was maturing as a hitter in those years. Going into spring training, he makes a few adjustments. The key adjustment for him was twofold, I think. One, standing deeper in the batter's box. It allowed him to see the ball better. Number two, being more patient. He was so eager in the early years of his career, and he felt a lot of pressure to hit the long ball. You know, in 1953, he becomes really known for hitting these quote-unquote tape measure shots. That's where the publicist of the Yankees, Red Patterson, went outside of the stadium after Mantle had hit a long ball out of the park against the Washington Senators, and he supposedly, but really didn't, measure the distance from home plate with a tape measure and claimed that it went 565 feet. And it created this legend. And Mickey was always, you know, he's competing against the shadow of Ruth, but also his own legend that had been created by the sports writers and the Yankees publicist. But back to 1956, you know, when he makes these adjustments at the plate, you know, he's really starting to say to himself, okay, I don't have to hit every ball out of the park. And so I think that patience, I think his willingness to wait for his pitch, he had seen many of these pitchers in the American League. I think that was a key ingredient for him, and he had early success. He had a phenomenal April, an outstanding May. By the end of May, he had already hit 20 home runs. He was ahead of Ruth's pace, and so I think his confidence grew the more success he had early in the season, and it also helped, of course, that he had Yogi Berra in the lineup with him as well, who also had a very good early start. But that pressure would continue because day after day, reporters were comparing Mantle's pace to Ruth's pace. And so I think Mickey really felt that enormous pressure, the weight. You know, you would see this in the New York newspapers. Could Mantle keep it up? It was the question that he was asked over and over again. And I'm sure he got tired of it. And ultimately, and by late August, he would fall off of Ruth's pace. But he was still in position to win the Triple Crown. And that became really the main story from September to the end of the regular season.
And remind our listeners what that term Triple Crown means in Major League Baseball.
Yes, great question. So the Triple Crown means that a batter has led the league in home runs, RBIs, and batting average, all three categories. In 1956, Mickey Mantle wins the Triple Crown not only in his American League, but also the National League. That means that there was no other hitter in 1956 who had more home runs or more RBIs or hit for a better batting average than Mickey Mantle. This was truly a remarkable feat. What we have to keep in mind, too, is that when Mantle does this in 56, he was only the fifth player in Major League history who had led all leagues or all batters in both leagues in all three categories. And in fact, since 1956, there has not been a single batter who has won the Triple Crown for all of baseball. We've had three who've won in the American League, but no one who's done what Mickey did. And no switch hitter, certainly, who has won the Triple Crown like Mickey Mantle did in 1956.
We're speaking with Johnny Smith, co-author of The Season in the Sun, which looks at the 1956 season of Mickey Mantle, an extraordinary season by any mark, one of the greatest seasons that any Major League Baseball player has ever had. But we have to add that your book is not only about Mickey Mantle, the baseball player, and his greatness, particularly in this 56 season when he finally became the star that he wanted to be and that many people thought he could be. This is also about America in 1956 and how hungry America was collectively for a hero like Mickey Mantle. Explain what was going on in the world and in our country at this point in time that made the story of Mickey Mantle such a feel-good story for just about every average American following baseball, even to the slightest degree?
That's a great question. So let's go back to the 1950s. It's the Cold War. And in the 1950s, Americans in increasing numbers are moving to the suburbs. It's the age of suburbanization. And in fact, baseball owners were concerned because attendance was lagging, and they were trying to figure out why that was. People were driving their automobiles. They were commuting to work, living on the outskirts of the cities. But in the Cold War, in the 1950s, this age of suburbanization, you know, it's the age of Little Leagues. This is when Little League baseball becomes really important in communities. And at that time, many parents were concerned about a couple of issues. One was, certainly, subversives, communists, recruiting their children. This was something that people read about in the newspapers. They heard Joseph McCarthy talking about it. And so there was this red scare. On the other side, parents were worried about the rise in juvenile delinquency. They would read about gangs robbing old ladies and breaking into stores and stealing things. And so parents were alarmed by these forces of subversion, you know. So baseball plays an important role. Adults believe that baseball was an important cultural force, that it could teach young boys, and mostly boys, the right values, democratic virtues, character, discipline, loyalty. And if they had those values, they would resist the gangs. They would resist the communist recruiters. And that's why Mickey Mantle was all more important. He was packaged by the Yankees and the sports writers and advertisers as the all-American athlete, right? Not just handsome and rugged, but strong, physically fit, the ideal man that young boys should aspire to be like. This was someone who embodied the values of the American dream, the rags-to-riches story. And so he really becomes the embodiment of the ideal role model for young kids who are playing baseball. At the same time, in the 1950s, we have this moment when Americans are embracing this bigger is better philosophy. Americans who move out to the suburbs, they buy larger homes. They have wider cars that are covered in chrome. They buy bigger television sets, larger refrigerators. Everything is bigger. It's an age of consumption. Mantle embodied this bigger is better philosophy. He was this muscular slugger. He was built like an Adonis. and he hit the ball farther than anyone has ever seen during this time. People hadn't seen Ruth for decades. We have to keep that in mind. And so Mickey Mantle, when he hits a home run, what he does is tap into that American reverence for power, right? The way he harnessed that raw power, he provides that instant gratification. And so Americans really idolized him for the way that he harnessed that power. And so in the atomic age, Mickey Mantle, this muscular batter, really becomes America's favorite athlete. He's the face of baseball. At a time when the owners are concerned about attendance, when Mantle and the Yankees go on the road in the American League cities, the attendance basically goes from about 12,000 fans per game to 22,000 fans per game. Mickey Mantle is an athlete who shapes the crowd. His name is on the marquee, and so he attracts attention in a way that no other player did at that point in time.
Talk for a moment about the silence around his character flaws or failings that the average fan knew nothing about, his carousing, his drinking, his philandering. And how conscious was that avoidance by the press to cover those matters, to really even make mention of them? Was it an omission that was very conscious, very deliberate for a purpose? Or was it just, in a sense, part of a culture that, in a sense, just didn't care about those things? And so it would never even occurred to the average sports writer to make mention of such matters in Mickey Mantle's personal life.
That's a great question. The philosophy of the sports writers in the 1950s, and in the decades before, really, since the age of Ruth, was that you protected baseball as an institution. And the writers believe that in protecting baseball as an institution, you protected the ballplayers. They were in the business of creating legends, of creating heroes. It was the old Grantland Rice approach to sports writing, godding up the ballplayers. You know, and so the players' image that was created in the minds of the fans was a fabrication. It was created by the media. Now, the other thing we should keep in mind about these writers is that they really operated by a certain code. What they saw behind the scenes in the clubhouse or on the team's railroad cars or in the bars, where they traveled closely with the guys, they saw them probably more often than their wives. But that code was, what you see here stays here. You know, if a ball player had an indiscretion or got caught up in some kind of potential controversy, as long as it didn't affect his performance on the field, the writers were not going to comment on it. You know, they basically had the approach that they needed to have the cooperation of the organization as if they were on the Yankees payroll. And so they really acted as publicists for Mickey Mantle as much as they did as reporters. Those columnists really packaged the Mickey Mantle that the fans saw. Now, behind the scenes, you mentioned sort of the carousing and the drinking and the private life of Mickey Mantle. We should talk about that. One of the key points that Randy Roberts and I try to show in our book is that to understand what it was like to be Mickey Mantle, you have to follow him outside of the ballpark. You have to go with him and Billy Martin and Whitey Ford and Yogi Berra into the Copacabana, into Tootsie Shores, into Danny's Hideaway. And imagine that you're there and you spot the most famous ballplayer in the country, a celebrity of New York City. What happens in that moment then is that the men in that bar or that nightclub, they want to meet Mickey Mantle. They want to shake his hand. They want to buy him a drink. And what it meant to be Mickey Mantle in that moment was that you had to accept that drink. Being a man in the 1950s meant drinking hard. Being a ball player meant drinking hard and playing hard. Mickey would later say that you proved your manhood by being able to drink late into the night, show up the next day, and knock one out of the park. That's what other men respected. And so drinking was really glorified in this culture. You know, drinking was about masculinity. And so I think for Mantle, there was pressure, social and cultural pressure, to live up to that sort of expectation. At the same time, of course, Mickey would later say that after his father died in 1952, he wasn't sure how to grieve. And he turned to the bottle, and he drank more and more in the coming years as a sort of escape to numb the pain from the loss of his father and to avoid the responsibilities of being a young husband and father. And so what we try to do in our book is show how all of these cultural forces and the personal frustrations and sadness that he dealt with were intertwined. And that's Mickey Mantle's world that we try to recreate.
Hmm. A last question. What was most valuable for you in looking back over such a long distance of time to this crucial season in Mickey Mantle's career? Who did you speak to, or what did you read, or what did you uncover that was, in a sense, most illuminating to you and your co-author?
You know, Randy and I agreed from the beginning that we had to look at Mickey Mantle from a different perspective. In the other Mantle biographies, and there's some good ones, there's always this framing of Mantle as a tragic hero, that he was on this road to alcoholism. And certainly, you know, he was an alcoholic. But what we wanted to do was show that in the 1950s, particularly in 56, the American public didn't look at Mickey Mantle as an alcoholic. They didn't look at him as a man on the road to a tragic ending. They saw him at the height of his fame and glory and his success. So we wanted to recreate that, to show readers how Mickey Mantle was viewed in this moment, at this watershed in his life. To do that meant reading all the major New York newspapers day after day. I think we probably looked at 6 or 7 daily papers from New York the entire season, other seasons too, national magazines. And what that allowed us to do was to follow him through the season, to see how the reporters were creating the hero, packaging this image, how fans were responding to him as he pursued Ruth's home run record and the Triple Crown. And really following him through that season through the New York newspapers allowed us to uncover the Mickey Mantle of the 1950s, America's favorite athlete.
The book, again, is A Season in the Sun, The Rise of Mickey Mantle, published by Basic Books. And the co-authors, Randy Roberts, and my guest today, Johnny Smith. Johnny Smith, congratulations on writing a really important and entertaining book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much.
And the time is 8:42. You are listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. And here is part two from the Morning Show archives. Sports fans, and certainly NPR sports fans, know the name John Feinstein very, very well. Rightly so, for a number of superb books which he has written, in addition to all of the good work he has done for Sports Illustrated, Washington Post, Golf World, and so on. His books include A Good Walk Spoiled, A Season on the Brink, and Where Nobody Knows Your Name. And John Feinstein is also had great success writing sports-themed books for young readers. He and I have spoken about a couple of those different books, including Last Shot, Vanishing Act, Cover Up, and his most recent book of that nature is a book called The Walk-On, May the Best Quarterback Win, in which John Feinstein paints a really riveting portrait of what happens in a football-hungry town when a very talented quarterback moves to town and, as a freshman, already demonstrates spectacular skills but has very little hope of unseating the incumbent quarterback, who also happens to be the very stern football coach's son. It's a very, very interesting scenario, painted and executed very, very authentically. And I'm very excited to have this opportunity to speak with John Feinstein about a number of sports matters, but especially about this book called The Walk-On, published by Alfred A. Knopf. John Feinstein, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Greg, good to talk to you. How are you?
Just fine. I'm really, really happy for this opportunity. I read this book cover to cover, and I absolutely loved it. And I have to tell you something that have you comment on something I told my wife just this morning, which is that when it comes to fiction, in many ways, I almost enjoy a book like this more than anything else. I mean, in other words, a book which really was designed for, I suppose, a middle school or high school reader at best, I found thoroughly engrossing and very enjoyable. And I wonder how much you think about, or in what way you think about, young readers specifically when you write a book like this. And if it's okay with you, if some of us out here who are adults enjoy the book as well.
No, it's more than okay with me, Greg. I'm very happy to hear that, and I hear that a fair bit. You know, when I'm writing these books, and with The Walk On being a new series in particular, I do want to draw in the younger audience. I want the middle school kids and the high school kids to relate to Alex and the teenage problems that he's dealing with, whether it's his first crush or moving to a new town and being the new kid in school. And then there are all the sports issues that are really the focus of the book. But at the same time, I do remember when I was a new father and watching things like Sesame Street and some of the Disney movies with my kids, and realizing that there were certain moments where they were actually targeting the grown-ups. I still remember famously Robin McNeil interviewing Cookie Monster, which was one of the great bits I've ever seen. And I laughed at it harder than my son, who was 4 or 5 at the time, did. And then as he got older, he came to understand it better. So when I hear an adult like you say, hey, I really enjoyed the mystery, I really enjoyed the story, or maybe I enjoyed the sort of lessons that I'm trying to throw in when I write these books, I'm very glad to hear it. So the more the merrier, and you're not the first adult to make that comment to me, and I consider it a compliment.
Very good. So this scenario of the young man moving to a very strange town just as he's a freshman in high school, something which really happened to me, actually, although I was not the quarterback on the football team, I can tell you that. But I remember how hard it was to make a move like this at this point in time. You know, even if you're a talented athlete, when it's a big school full of strangers, even a freshman like Alex, brilliantly talented though he is, can really be lost and bewildered. Tell us more about that scenario, why you thought it was fertile ground for a book like this, and what you drew upon to paint this picture so realistically.
Well, I think a lot of kids go through the difficulties of changing schools or moving to a new city for whatever the reason might be when they're teenagers. I changed schools between my freshman and sophomore years of high school. Didn't change cities, but changed schools. And I remember how difficult that was. And I was an athlete. I was a good swimmer. That's why I changed schools. And it was still very difficult for me because everybody kind of looked at me like I had two heads for a while. And I think that happens, particularly in the teenage years, when you're first becoming aware of, you know, of in my case, girls, in Alex's case, girls, and all that goes on with that change of life. And I think that makes it even tougher. And as you said, he's going into a big public school in Philadelphia. He's grown up in Boston. He's a Boston sports fan. Now he's in Philadelphia, and everybody's kind of looking at him like, who are you? And it is very difficult for him.
One of the things that's interesting, too, is that Alex, as a brilliant young quarterback, faces this really thorny situation of having to carry himself just right, to try to be confident and yet not cocky, and sort of knowing his place in the team and yet not knowing how much he should settle for being third string when he clearly deserves through his talent to be more than that, and what his attitude should be towards the other players. I mean, I found myself really feeling for Alex in this kind of situation where, on top of the challenging game of football, there is also, in a sense, sort of the politics he had to play or to sort of make his way in that kind of respect, which can't be easy for a young man like that.
Yeah, I think you've got it exactly right. And what I tried to do, Greg, as you know because you've read the book, is I didn't want to make it a black-and-white situation where he's the good guy and the first-string quarterback is the bad guy. The first-string quarterback is actually a good guy. And that makes it in some ways more difficult for Alex because he can't hate the kid. He likes the kid. And yet he still wants to play. He still wants to be the starter. And it's the father who's the coach who is the issue, not only for him but for the first-string quarterback, because the coach father is putting so much pressure on his son to be a star, as we discussed earlier. So it is a thorny situation, and I try not to oversimplify. I think when we were kids growing up, there was a tendency to oversimplify kids' books. kids today are much more sophisticated than that. You've got to give them a story that they can sit back and say, this is believable. I think this could happen. I think I've been in situations that might in some ways be similar to this. And I tried to draw that picture throughout the book. But clearly, yes, it's not easy for Alex on any level.
One of the things mentioned in the book is something I've never heard of, and I would love for you to talk about a little bit. And that is some of the members of this team who eventually come to see Alex and see what a brilliant quarterback he is, and yet relegated to third string. It appears in the early going, at least, that there is no way he's going to see any kind of significant playing time whatsoever. And more than one of them suggests the possibility of Alex being held back in school.
Right.
So he's around yet another year, which would give him, in a sense, one more year of high school eligibility as a starter once Matt Gordon, the incumbent, has graduated and moved on. And they talk about this as though it's relatively commonplace. In fact, does this happen?
Yes, Greg, it does. It has become relatively commonplace. There are many parents nowadays who are have kids who are athletes who will hold their son or even daughter back a year. It happens a lot in football because of the size issue. You know, you want your kid to get bigger and stronger, and you give them an extra year of high school. You have them repeat the ninth grade or go to a prep school at the end of 12th grade. They do it on both ends. There are a lot of prep schools now, postgraduate prep schools, where athletes go for a year before they enroll in college, and then sometimes they redshirt their freshman year, so they're 20 years old by the time they have their first year of eligibility. So, yes, for better or worse, it is a very common practice now. You see a lot of kids who are freshmen in college who are 19 or 20 years old who are athletes.
Wow. As I read this book, a couple of things came up. One of them is that there were certain points in time when we're talking about injuries that occur on the field, and that's one of the things we hear the most about in terms of football right now, is the toll that it takes, whether we're talking about a retired NFL veteran whose body is completely broken down or facing maybe early onset dementia because of the injuries they've sustained, or if we're talking about even much younger athletes who find their playing days suddenly cut short or suffering maybe devastating injuries. I wonder if you could just say a word about how much we are thinking about this now versus when you first began writing about sports. Have we traveled any significant distance in terms of taking this seriously and doing something about it?
We have traveled a significant distance, Greg, but we are still a long way from figuring it out. I saw a quote from a concussion specialist fairly recently who said we're only in the infant stages of understanding what head injuries do to the brain, that the doctors are still learning as they go. And 20, 30 years from now, I would think the way head injuries are treated and the way we deal with football and the potential for head injuries will be different now than it is, even though a lot has changed. But you're right about the way the approach to football has changed, even in the last 5 years, but more so in the last 20 years. I did a book 10 years ago where I spent a year with the Baltimore Ravens, an NFL team, and I began the book describing a scene after the Ravens' last game of the season, and they walked out of a team meeting and walked down a hallway to the locker room, and I could honestly say, looking around, remember, these were the players who had played the day before, not the ones who were on the injured list. I was the only one walking upright. I was the only one who didn't have some kind of injury at that point, because I obviously hadn't played. Football is a very violent game. And if you watch from the sidelines, as I've had the opportunity to do, then you have an understanding of just how violent it is. You see these extraordinary collisions, whether it's NFL, college, or high school, and everybody gets up 99% of the time and trots back to the huddle, and you don't know how anybody got up from that collision. And that's, one of the points I'm trying to make. One of the things Alex says in the second book in this series, Christine, who's the female lead character, says, "What's your favorite sport?" And he says, "It's either basketball or baseball." And she says, "But you're so good at football." And he says, "Yeah, but football's really hard to play. It hurts to play football." And I think that's accurate.
Mm. One of the issues facing the game right now is whether football athletes at the collegiate level should be paid or compensated more directly than is the case right now. Do you have a personal opinion about that?
Yeah, I have a very strong one. I believe that athletes who generate millions and sometimes billions of dollars in revenue for these big-time college programs in football and men's basketball should receive some compensation. I happen to have agreed with the judge in the Ed O'Bannon case who ruled that athletes should have a trust fund set up for them and should have money put into that trust fund while they're in school. I've been advocating this for 25 years. And people at the collegiate level say, well, what about Title IX? What about non-revenue athletes? Well, you write the rule very simply. If your sport generates revenue for the school, net revenues, then you take part in that trust fund. I think the judge in the O'Bannon case was headed in the right direction and that there should be some compensation. I'm not saying they should be employees or they should get a check every 2 weeks because then all sorts of tax issues with their scholarships come into play. But there is a way to acknowledge that these young men, and they're men, with the exception of a couple of women's basketball programs at places like Connecticut and Tennessee, are bringing in millions and billions of dollars to the NCAA and to these colleges. And to call them amateurs is absolutely ridiculous.
Hmm. A last quick question. I characterize this Pennsylvania high school as sort of football crazy. Does it ever make you nervous when you look at a high school where football, and it's true of so many high schools across the country, where football is so important? If you could wave a magic wand, would you somehow wish it not to be so, to be not quite such a craze for so many Americans?
I would, actually, Greg. And as you can tell reading the book, I have serious reservations and doubts about the power of a football coach at the high school level and how much winning football games means to everybody associated with the high school. Because as you said, even though I've created a fictional school here, it's based on reality, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the country. Go back to Friday Night Lights years and years ago. That's been going on for many years. And I wish there was some way to communicate to people that, look, it's great to care about sports. It's great to participate. It's great to root for your kids. But again, go back to what I said earlier. Let them play the sports. That's why I wanted Alex to be a three-sport athlete, so that he and his family aren't obsessed with him working at one sport. Let kids play the games. If you win, that's fantastic. But you know what? If you lose, having tried to win is should be part of sports. I know that sounds corny, but the trying to win is just about as important as winning itself. The best words I've ever read about sports sit in the lobby of the Palestra in Philadelphia, and it says, to play the game is great, to win the game is greater, but to love the game is the greatest thing of all. And I know that sounds corny, Greg, but it'd be wonderful if we could get back to something that simple.
I love that. And the book I loved as well, The Walk-On, May the Best Quarterback Win, the first in a series of three books, The Triple Threat, and all by best-selling author John Feinstein. Thank you, John Feinstein, for writing yet another wonderful book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show.
Greg, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview I am very, very excited about. I'll be welcoming back into our studios Dr. Jonathan Shaler, a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. We'll be talking about a very memorable experience that actually both of us had a week ago tomorrow. I went to the Racine Correctional Institution and for the first time got to see one of the performances by Dr. Shaler's Shakespeare in Prison project. They performed Shakespeare's Cymbeline, and it was an amazing performance, and it was an amazing experience to be within the walls of that prison and to see these men perform such a fine performance of Cymbeline. And so we will talk about that performance and Shakespeare in Prison with Dr. Shaler on tomorrow's morning show. I hope you'll make a special point of joining us. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the program is archived on our website, wgtd.org.